Carroll versus Commonwealth, Lauren H. Harrison, Appellate Counsel, Christopher P. Chenzel, Assistant Attorney General, Appellate Counsel.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Norman Lampson, counsel for Tarsha Gerald. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I am representing the daughter of Patricia in this case. It's a perjury and misdemeanor driving on a suspended license case. On the perjury, we have a question of insufficiency of the evidence due to failure to prove the question, which is kind of a different argument than you just heard, and in the alternative venue. And I have but an unpublished decision of the Court of Appeals directly on point that in these circumstances, you deal with insufficiency first, and then you deal with venue. So I ask the Court to adopt that rule. It makes sense to me. On the question of insufficiency of the evidence here, the first thing we have to pin down is just what exactly are the words that are said to be perjurious, because we're all over the place. The Court of Appeals said there were two words, one, the denial of driving on direct, and second, denying that she said her license was suspended to Miller on cross. The Court of Appeals says there are three statements. My contention is my client was indicted for, tried for, and convicted of a perjury in denying driving on direct examination, and that's it. The indictment doesn't specify the words, but the Commonwealth's attorney, Ms. Lowe, repeatedly referred to the perjury in denying driving. At one point, she called it the actual perjury. I quoted from her argument in closing argument and also in my motion to reconsider. She never referred to the statements on cross-examination as perjury. She did argue they were false, but she used them in this manner. Miller was not present, so she said, well, in the general district court, my client was asked, you know, did you meet with Miller? No. Did you admit you're involved in an accident? No. Did you admit driving? No. Did you admit you had a suspended license? No. She felt that my client, because Miller wasn't there, thought she could get up and lie about it with impunity, and that showed willfulness and evil mind. And since her denial of driving was made at the same time and place, she made that statement willfully. That's how she used it. But my client has been convicted of only one set of words. Now, the Commonwealth proceeds on this theory. This is their theory. They assume the question was something like, were you driving on 250 west of Charlottesville, headed eastbound, May 26 in the afternoon? And then they have proof. She said, I denied driving. That's from Officer Scopoletti. He was an ear witness, so to speak. So based on the assumption that that's the question, and then evidence of what the answer was, that is his oral testimony, what she said in the prior proceeding, they put on Welch to falsify. They're going to say, basically, you know, see, it was false testimony. But you can't assume the question in a perjury case. You've got to prove it. There's nothing on this record that proves what the question was. We don't even know if that was an answer to a question or whether she blurted it out. Furthermore, Your Honors, Officer Scopoletti admitted he didn't recall any of the questions either of these ladies was asked. Nothing on their direct testimony, nothing in their answers. He did say they testified one after the other. We don't know how long the question was. Did Patricia testify an hour? Did she testify 5 minutes? And vice versa. We don't know who went first. If we assume Patricia went first, then then what he said was, you know, his tentacles got to quivering when you had the statement of denial of driving. That's when Ms. Lowe said to him, pay attention. And she had Miller's notes, and he had Miller's notes. So then he can remember at least, looks to me like four questions on cross-examination. And the Commonwealth has three, the panel has one other question. And he's clear on that. Well, then Patricia gets off the stand. My client gets on the stand. Now, again, he has a total blank. He can't tell us what any of the questions are to my client. The statement goes with the question, like the collard with the greens. You can't separate them out. If you don't have proof of the questions, you don't have proof of the statement, and then hence you don't have proof of falsity in the case. The same principle applies to the materiality. You can't show materiality in this case.
Counsel, is it your view that absent a transcript, perjury could never be proved?
No, Your Honor, and in fact, I made the statement the opposite in the lower court. The Commonwealth attributes that to me. I don't say you need a transcript, but you have to have the substance of the testimony. In fact, that's what the Commonwealth says. So again, if the question was, were you driving eastbound in the afternoon on 250 West, but officer, at 4 o'clock, and the officer says, well, she testified she was driving eastbound in the afternoon. You know, it was not the exact words, in the afternoon versus 4 o'clock. That's a little kind of a thing. I'm not going to quibble on that. He could testify to the substance. But his candid testimony was he couldn't remember anything. And you have no other witnesses. The judge couldn't be a witness. The two lawyers withdrew to potentially be witnesses. They weren't called. Welsh was there, but they didn't call him. And Ms. Lowe declined to recuse herself. So she couldn't be a witness, and she wasn't a witness. So I contend that this is an independent rule. And I cited Lord Kenyon's rule. You know, in 1791, you have to prove the entirety of the testimony in a perjury case. Now, this court has never addressed that precedent, but it has recognized the statute that the Commonwealth mentions on brief that we had from 1846 to 1996. It eliminated the requirement of the common law that you had to recite the entirety of the record in the plea. But that statute kept the requirement you had to prove the entirety of the record. It just eliminated a pleading requirement is all it did. And that statute ended, but nothing herein shall eliminate the requirement that the Commonwealth must prove the entirety of the testimony and cannot introduce a part without the defendant's consent. Now, that was repealed in 1996, but it wasn't repealed because the legislature wanted to change the rule so that you could just introduce a part of the testimony in the prosecution. That is a part of the testimony where they said the perjury occurred. It was repealed because they just wanted it to be so that perjury indictments would be subject to the same general requirements as any other felony indictment. That's why they appealed it. So, and this court has recognized that. This court has recognized that in its precedents. So my contention is the evidence is insufficient. It's not just an insufficiency of the evidence in terms of, you know, there are other hypothetical possibilities. It's just a rule. It's like the two witness rule. I mean, suppose you have a case where there's gobs of proof beyond a reasonable doubt but haven't satisfied the two witness rule or one witness in corroborating circumstances. It's still insufficient evidence because of that rule. Now,
may I ask you this? If what is the denial really that you're focusing on? The denial of driving at the time of the accident, before the time of the accident, or after the accident?
Well, again, with no proof of the question, I guess we don't really know what it is. I mean, they're saying that she denied driving. That's all they're saying. They're not saying she denied driving before the accident, at the time of the accident, or after. We don't know. Because all they've proven is those words.
Okay, so if she said, I wasn't driving, and she was driving, certainly after the accident, right?
Well, there's direct examination testimony of Paul Welsh that she was, yes. That's how they try to prove falsity.
And she was defending herself, correct me if I'm wrong, to a driving on a suspended license?
That's defended. I mean, it's...
So why does it really matter exactly the moment of her driving if she made an unqualified denial of driving and she was found guilty of driving?
Well, I mean, it could be a denial of driving to, again, going from Charlottesville to Waynesboro to get the groceries, and there's no proof that she was driving there. It could be, you know, she did not drive in going from Charlottesville to the point of accident. There's no proof she was driving to the point of the accident. So
did she drive after the accident?
Well, that's the Commonwealth's contention. And I, again, I don't dispute that the trial court could believe Welch that she was. I don't dispute that. Okay. My problem is they're assuming that the question was, were you driving under that circumstance? And there's no evidence of it, Judge. Your Honor?
Well, she's defending herself against a charge of driving on a suspended license. She says, I wasn't driving, period, right? Do I have anything? Am I missing anything right there?
No, denial of driving.
All right, and she's found guilty of driving, and there's a witness that saw her driving. I'm missing the complexity of it. Just help me out.
They have to prove the question to prove that the statement is false. We don't know the falsity unless we know relative to what the question is.
Were you driving? No.
I guess that's seems like to me your issue is you don't know what she said I wasn't driving in response to. You're saying you need the question.
Yes.
Were you driving on Christmas Day? No, I was not driving. So she made the statement she wasn't driving, but you don't know in response to what question she made that statement.
That's my point, and hence, we don't know falsity because, I mean, it may have been she wasn't driving on Christmas Day. And that's even if the trial court believed Welch, again.
Well, is that hypothesis of innocence in the record, or even, for that matter, even arguable, that the question could have been, were you driving when you were 10 years old versus when you were driving on Christmas Day versus you're charged with driving on this day, were you driving?
Well, I have two responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, I think, you know, when you look at a common law rule that you've got to recite the record and then you've got to prove the record, I think you need to prove the record. I really don't think you can use circumstantial evidence in a perjury case just by its nature as to what the record was. I don't think we can create it. I would, of course, argue that my hypothesis flow from the evidence and not from the imagination of counsel. But I would still say that this is an independent rule of itself, that you must produce the entirety of the defendant's testimony in the prior proceeding. Your Honor, moving to the venue issue, which is in the alternative, we contend that if my client committed perjury in the courtroom, she did it in the city and not in the county. You've heard about the general venue statute. The Charlottesville Circuit Court does have courts that were created in 1888. I introduced about 12 maps, you know, that show it's in the city. I asked the court to take judicial notice. She ruled that the better argument is that Section 48 varies the venue. That, of course, implies a finding by the court that it's in the city, and I don't disagree with that. And so I asked this court to also find the courthouse is in the city. And I think you should do it by judicial notice. Appellate courts do it, take judicial notice, just as do trial courts. So that leads to the Section 48 argument. The Section 48 somehow changes a venue. Of course, I don't dispute that the property is owned by the county. It's within the limits of the city. Within the limits of the city. On appeal, the Commonwealth's only argument was Section 48. That is, they never argued, as they did in the trial court, that it was in the county. The panel makes a nullity argument I've addressed in my brief. The Commonwealth below made what I call a Murray argument, that basically the word authorities just means exclusively courts. These are both false. Let's apply interpretive principles. When a word appears twice in the law, and the word authorities appears twice, then if you know its meaning at one point, it's going to have the same meaning at the other, unless the context clearly indicates otherwise. Who are these authorities who shall not subject the property to taxation? It's clearly the legislative authorities, and exclusively the legislative authorities. The charter gives the city council 13 provisions where they alone can tax, and in general law, the county legislative body alone can tax. So that's its meaning the second time. It follows that's its meaning the first time, unless the context indicates otherwise. It does not, and so that's its meaning. It means legislative jurisdiction. It follows that the word jurisdiction means legislative jurisdiction of these legislative bodies. It does not mean judicial jurisdiction. So the thorny knot for the Court of Appeals just does not arise. That is, they proceed on the assumption it means courts, and then they think it means judicial means jurisdiction means judicial jurisdiction. So how do we unravel the thorny knots? We know courts can't act together; they can't act unitedly. So they look to sister states. They look to federal courts, and you just don't. You just the thorny knot does not arise. There's no reason you can't say that. Joint means what it traditionally means for 200 years. It means you don't have to look to sister states. It means acting together, and the legislature knows how to use the word when they want to. Furthermore, in general statutes, you have a laundry list of cases where they've got this city-county situation. The town grows around the county. It converts to city status, causing the county courthouse to be in the city. They've had opportunity to add Charlottesville and Albemarle to the laundry list. They have not. They instead have a statute that the city judge can use the county court, the county judge can use the city court. And finally, exceptions are strictly construed. The Commonwealth is relying on this as an exception. If there are any questions, and I reserve my argument, my contention about driving on a suspended license.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good morning again, and may it please the court, Chris Chanaville for the Commonwealth. In this appeal, Gerald argues a couple things. Argues, first of all, that the evidence was insufficient to prove that she committed perjury because there was no direct testimony of the exact question that was asked, which elicited the first perjured response in general district court. Of course, that argument only goes to the first perjured statement that she made and does not go to the second two perjured statements that she made in that court. And therefore, this court can affirm on any basis supported by the record as long as no factual findings are required, and therefore can affirm without reaching the separate question of whether or not those exact questions have to be proved by direct testimony. However, for the reasons I've stated on brief, what was at one time the common law rule that you were required to plead and prove all of the exact nature of all of the proceedings below where that perjured testimony occurred. While that may have been the law in this Commonwealth at one time, and while Ms. Gerald may have been correct and may have a point at least as to that first statement at that time, that has not been the law in the Commonwealth since 1846. In 1846, the General Assembly passed a statute which was similar to a statute which had been passed in England, which was intended to abrogate that common law rule. So since that time, there's no longer been a requirement to plead the exact questions, and there's no longer been a requirement to prove the exact questions. The argument has been made that, well, maybe they were just taking away the pleading requirement, but weren't also taking away the proof requirement. The proof requirement was born out of that pleading requirement. That's how the common law rule developed. So because you were required to plead the exact nature, the exact circumstances of all the prior proceedings, you're also required to prove it. And so when in England that was removed by statute, and then in Virginia we did the same. When you remove the pleading requirement, you also remove the proof requirement, and therefore that common law rule, which was never even a rigid common law rule, but that common law rule, to the extent that it's ever applied in the Commonwealth, certainly no longer applies today. So what the court is left with is determining, well, how do we examine an argument like this that the evidence is insufficient because the Commonwealth failed to prove the questions, and it really just becomes a very standard hypothesis of innocence case. The hypothesis is that maybe she was testifying about denying driving on some other occasion, but every hypothesis of innocence has to flow from the evidence. There is no evidence in the record that she, to even suggest or imply that she might have ever been asked in general district court about whether she was driving on some different occasion. The trial in circuit court was a misdemeanor appeal, and the Commonwealth's theory in circuit court was that she denied driving away from the scene of the accident. It's perfectly reasonable to conclude that that is the driving she was being asked about and when she was tried for the very same offense in general district court. And for that reason, the evidence sufficiently disproved that hypothesis of innocence. It was reasonable to reject it. So as to the first assignment of error, the evidence was sufficient. As to the second assignment of error, as to venue, for the reasons argued earlier, venue was proper. This is a special venue statute. There's, as I understand the argument being made by counsel for Ms. Tarsha Gerald, the argument appears to go something like this. One of the definitions for the word joint is united, and it would be absurd to interpret the word joint jurisdiction to mean that these prosecutors have to, and courts have to act in united fashion together at the same time in order to prosecute a case like this. And because that's one of the definitions for joint, and because that would lead to an absurd result, we have to come up with some way of reading the statute to get around that absurd result. And the way that counsel for Ms. Gerald has suggested is you add the word legislative to governing authorities and officers and treat that as only legislative authorities and officers, and that avoids the absurd result. But the absurd result is one that is created entirely by Ms. Gerald, because another definition for joint is that the jurisdiction is shared between the two. That's a definition that was adopted by the trial judge. That is a proper definition, and it's a definition that should apply. That avoids the absurd result, and it avoids this court having to add language to the statute that is not already there. I would also like to point out quickly that even if there were any ambiguity about what the word authorities meant in 1888 when the statute was initially enacted, in 1900 the General Assembly added the word officers to that statute. And if you look just a paragraph earlier in that act of the Assembly, the General Assembly establishes certain offices within the Commonwealth, one of which is the office of a city judge. And the General Assembly then goes on to say that said officer shall continue in their position until a successor is named, and then gets further down and says joint jurisdiction for city and county authorities and officers. So even if there were any ambiguity, we're not suggesting that there is, but even if there were as to whether a judge counts as an office as an authority, it's certainly plainly clear, at least since 1900, that a judge in the city or county of Charlottesville or Albemarle certainly qualifies as an officer, and therefore there's joint and shared jurisdiction between courts of both jurisdictions. For all these reasons, we're asking this court to affirm. Unless there are any further questions, I'm happy to rest on my brief.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Williamson, you have 7 seconds remaining.
Judge, in just 7 seconds, I'll state that 23 George II, it eliminated the pleading requirement that you had to recite the entirety of the record. It did not eliminate the requirement that you had to prove the entirety of the record in the prior case.
All right. The court will be at recess until 11:15.
All right. Thank you.